Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Train Like a Trooper podcast. We've sort of been on hiatus for a little while, but we wanted to come back on this day and talk about an incident that is described as the darkest day in the history of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol. And that's when three troopers were slain. It was May 26, 1978, and it was two separate shootouts with two escaped Oklahoma State prison convicts, Claude Dennis and Michael Lancaster. This happened in the Caddo Kennefic area of Bryan County. The three troopers that were killed, Trooper Houston F. Pappy Summers, Trooper Billy G. Young, and Lieutenant Pat Grimes. And, you know, Trooper Foster and I have talked about this day quite a bit, and it's important to remember it. Obviously, it's a tragic day in our history. Not necessarily something we like to talk about, but we do talk about it. We talk about it in the academies with the cadets. It's something that needs to be remembered. There were lots of lessons learned about this day.
There were a lot of lessons, and there's a couple of reasons why we bring it up quite often. And one is obviously to pull out positives that we can learn from it, so that their lives, weren't spent in vain. That troopers following them could learn a lot of things, and law enforcement. In general, there are a lot of things that you'll hear on these interviews that we've done today that kind of explain that. The other reason is we want troopers, especially in the academy, to know the job that we do. And it's not just, what a lot of people say is just routine. There's no such thing as routine. And when we're out there to try to save lives from the public, that means that our job is dangerous, and we want people not to be in the mindset that, it's just a routine thing, that, right. It is dangerous, but it's necessary to keep people safe.
Correct. And so we're going to hear from Captain Ronnie Hampton, who he has done a lot of research on this topic. I believe he was 9 years old when this happened. He's from that area. He's done extensive research on it. And he's going to kind of go through what happened from the day these men escaped the prison to 34 days later when we had this shootout with our troopers. Then we also talked to Lieutenant Mike Williams. He was one of the troopers that he fatally wounded, one of the convicts, bringing all of this to an end. We talked to him and his wife about a year ago, and they talk about what they remember from that day as well. So we're going to start with Captain Ronnie Hampton.
To train like a trooper takes heart. It takes determination. It takes perseverance. It takes integrity. And it takes grit. Training like a trooper is a lifestyle, a mindset. It means never giving up, even when it gets tough. It means training your body as well as your mind. Do you have what it takes to train like a trooper?
Yeah, so kind of take us back, and this all started, so these suspects were in the McAllister prison.
Correct. They was in the McAllister prison. One had what we call fell for robbery out of northern Oklahoma. And the other, Dennis, was actually from the Caddo area. He had been convicted for a murder in Bryan County, and then he had been convicted for some murders in western Oklahoma, and that's what put them both in prison. What is interesting about this, and many people don't know this, but they actually had a prison guard help them with the escape. And actually, Hoyt Hughes, who had his partner killed, Pat Grimes, actually investigated that after he recovered from his injuries and was successful in getting the prison guard prosecuted.
So he was prosecuted, yes. That prison guard ultimately was?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, for the access he allowed them to certain tools.
Were they cellmates?
They were not. No, they were not cellmates. They worked in the same area.
Okay.
Of the prison. And so when he made, when he allowed them access to the tools, that's what allowed them to start formulating their escape. And then when they make the jailbreak on that Sunday, they just literally ran across the street from the prison and broke into the house of a prison guard who was at work, and took the prison guard's wife and child hostage. And that's where they first armed themselves with weapons and stole the Datsun. And so that was immediately reported to the McAllister police. But there was some delay in getting the broadcast out to the highway patrol. And so if now if you look in hindsight, they left the prison. They traveled westbound from the prison. A lot of people always think that someone's going to go hit an interstate roadway, such as the Indian Nations Turnpike that was right by the prison, or just a little bit east of there, Highway 69, that could take you to Dallas or Chicago. And that's not what these guys did. These guys were country boys. That's all they knew was rural Oklahoma, and they didn't do that. They went westbound, and they traveled that road that runs right by the prison. They took it due west for about 30 miles, and which took them straight towards Gertie, Oklahoma, and southern Hughes County. And so that's where I say the missed opportunities, because, you know, the news broadcasted then. We didn't have a 24-hour news cycle. You had your 10 o'clock news, and you had your morning news, and you had a little bit of farm and ranch news at noontime, but that's about all the news that you had as far as television went. And so after the 10 o'clock broadcast, a lady did see, remembered seeing that Datsun sitting on a side of a county road just outside of Gertie, and called that in. That's documented that she called that in, and there just wasn't anybody out then to check that. And so it went unchecked. And then the next morning, it does appear that they actually kidnapped the farmer from his residence there. As I said, the Datsun was found behind the barn, his barn. He went missing, and he has been missing ever since, and he has never been found. He nor his vehicle have ever been found. But we do know the next day that they were breaking into the brother-in-law's residence just outside of Duran, Oklahoma, in the community of Silo, which meets up to the north end of Lake Texoma, okay, near the Fort Washita area. And so, you know, knowing what their pattern was, one could suspect that that Ford pickup taken from the man who's never been found was most likely dumped into Lake Texoma at the north end, which, you know, recently, 7 or 8 years ago, the flood caused that dike to break, and it flooded that entire area was, you know, underwater by about 30 feet. So they stayed in that area for several days. And in about a month after they were killed, they actually did find a campsite near that north end that had prison clothes at it and had those pillowcases there. So so they got armed by day two. Sounds like there was multiple residential burglaries there for 3 or 4 days. Most people wrote that off as being just kids out for the summer breaking into stuff, not putting two and two together that, you know, that it was sandwich meat and things like that. And then the next sighting of these guys there was multiple missing people over the course of this. A lot of the people they killed were reported as missing people. They weren't actually found until after the shootout. And so there were two elderly men down in East Texas that they had accosted, similar to the way they did the man in Gertie. And obviously those people were found buried in a brush pile. They were basically, when they shot someone, they shot them in the head. Most of the time that was with a shotgun. So they were making sure the people were dead, and then they would cover their bodies in brushy areas and then drive their vehicles. And then that was the case. So, you know, when when they actually kidnapped and murdered, they kidnapped a lady from the convenience store in Denison, Texas, and then murdered the husband, then they had already had rafts loaded in the back of one of these stolen trucks. And so they get on the Red River and they basically paddle down the Red River and make a camp there between what's called the Carpenter's Bluff Bridge and the Red River Bridge that goes over US 75. And so she was able to escape after they fell asleep, and she made it back to US 75, flagged a truck driver down, and a pretty large manhunt ensued down there in the state of Texas. And then they, you know, again, what a lot of escapees will do, or anybody that's running from the police on foot that's been basically jumped up, you know, so they're not had a time to plan it, is most people will take the path of least resistance, which will either be train tracks or it'll be what we call power line cleans. So those areas where the power lines are, you know, the grass is cut down below those, but everything else may be timber around it. So you're taking basically the path of least resistance, and that's what they did. They walked the railroad tracks into Denison, Texas, and then accosted a 16-year-old boy who was mowing his grass and took him hostage all day and watched the news. Back then, the roadblocks weren't held very long, and so as soon as they could tell that the roadblocks had been released after the evening news that day, so they'd been about 8 hours after the manhunt started, they took his vehicle and they drove to Oklahoma, and that's where the sightings started over in Johnston County and then up into Pontotoc County. And that's really when they began to flee and begin to travel, you know, across the United States, next being picked up over in Mississippi and Alabama.
And then at what point in time did they make their way back into Oklahoma?
So after they had shot a police officer and wounded a trooper in two separate incidents, they had a large manhunt there. And we actually sent...
In the state of Mississippi?
It's on the Mississippi-Alabama state line.
Okay.
So it was a manhunt that was covering basically two states just because it was on their state line. So there's a lot of Alabama troopers there, a lot of Mississippi troopers there. And then we actually flew Lieutenant Haney to that location because he had been... gathering information, and he was feeding that back to our intel unit, which was Troop Z. And the only two people in Troop Z at that time was Lieutenant Hoyt Hughes and then Pat Grimes. Okay. And so in the file, a couple days before his death, Pat Grimes had actually took notes down that was called into him by John Haney, all right, providing information about what their method of operation was out there. And so they held those, they got information and they held their roadblocks and things like that, the Mississippi and Alabama authorities did. And then they murdered a lady in Cuba, Alabama, that was just outside their perimeter. And they stole her vehicle. And then the following day, obviously she was found. Dennis and Lancaster was suspected as being the ones that murdered her and took her vehicle. But then that afternoon is when a person over by Fort Ouachita, which is, again, that north end of the Lake Texoma, a person seen the car down almost in the water underneath some trees and called the highway patrol station in Durant. And Lieutenant Williams went out there and obtained the VIN off the dash because the tag had been removed, and they checked it through NCIC, and that's when they got the report of a stolen. And so he got a hold of Lieutenant Van Arsdale, and they spun up a manhunt. And what's interesting about this is, you know, a lot of our troopers today, they know that, you know, on holiday weekends, they have to collect Operation CARE activity. But this was actually the first year the Oklahoma Highway Patrol had participated in Operation CARE. So Memorial Day weekend was going to be the kickoff. And so, you know, we have a kind of a balancing act there. We had to keep troopers out on the roads to respond to the Memorial Day traffic, but we also needed 100 people that we could bring to Durant, Oklahoma, and hold a manhunt that weekend. And keep in mind, all this manhunt is occurring near Lake Texoma. Okay, so you know, we pulled from a lot of our special services units to staff that manhunt. And so a lot of these guys were brought in from all parts of Oklahoma, and we housed them at the Holiday Inn and at the dormitories at the University of Southeastern Oklahoma State University. And they were assigned, you know, assignments. And you know, that, you know, the day before the shootout, so on May the 25th is when Troopers Summers and Grimes got told to report to the manhunt. They get there late on the 25th. They bed down, and when they got back to the command post that morning for their assignment, that's where they were assigned, not a fixed location, but a roving patrol.
And that was Summers and Young,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes. And so they had a been assigned to run Nell's Cross, basically all the county roads between Highway 48, Highway 78, and US 69.
And were they technically road troopers, or were they kind of back then it was a little different, wasn't it?
Yes. So they were assigned to a division called Motor Vehicle Inspections. And so their job was to go around and check on the gas stations who issued inspection stickers to cars. Okay. And so that was the job that they had, you know, they'd, you know, been assigned to do. So that's why, you know, a lot of the units that were there were units that were either, or you know, our commercial motor vehicle units, or our size and weight units, or our safety education units, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And also some road units, you know, but we didn't completely, you know, pull everybody from the field areas because of the Memorial Day weekend and the first year we were participating in Operation CARE. And then you know, Dennis and Lancaster, you know, they basically did what they had done the whole time they'd been out. They walked the banks of the Blue River, all right, all the way from Fort Washita back to the east. And then they come across the Russell Washington place, and Dennis was familiar with that because he had actually hunted there, and because he is from Caddo, which is just about 4 miles northeast of there, east of the residence. And so they took Russell Washington and his hired hand, took them hostage. As they leave Washington, they steal his pickup. Washington gets loose almost immediately, and he picks up the telephone and calls the Highway Patrol Station in Durant. So he's actually telling them, they haven't even reached Highway 48 yet. So he's telling them, they're driving down my driveway, and he tells them they're going north from my driveway. There was a roadblock 1 mile south, okay? And there was a roadblock at Caddo and Kennefic, which was about 4 miles north. Okay. And then Summers and Young, they were both on a roving patrol on Nell's Crossing Road, which is about 3 miles north. And so they told them about the roadblock south. They didn't tell them about the roadblock north. Okay. So that's why they didn't go south, or that within seconds they would have encountered those troopers at that roadblock. So as they go north, of course, Dennis is familiar with that area, and he knows he can hit that county road 1 mile south of 78 and 22, and he can take that directly back into Caddo. And then that's what he did, and that's where Summers and Young encountered them on that county road there. And, of course, the aircraft was in the area. The aircraft was heading that direction as soon as Washington made the telephone call. And as the two troopers out on the county road was able to get a radio transmission out. This is Victor 54. We've got them, and we've been hit. They were able to get that radio traffic out. So everybody in the area knew that those two troopers had encountered them on that county road, but then they lost radio contact with them. So they knew that they were looking for a blue Ford pickup. And so our aircraft actually spotted a blue Ford pickup up on Highway 22. And they actually made a traffic stop on that, had a trooper make a traffic stop on that vehicle, and it wasn't the correct vehicle. Mm-hmm. So then the pilot and its observer began to look south of there along that county road, and that's when they picked up the pickup traveling at a high speed eastbound about a mile from where they just killed the troopers. And so that's when he begins to look at where all these black and whites are, could see a lot of them around Caddo, and began to try to direct them in. But none of them were familiar, and they didn't have roof numbers, so he couldn't point to a specific unit.
Mm. So how exactly did they kill Summers and Young?
So what it looks like is that Trooper Young had moved out from the driver's side of Victor 54 and went out and fired rounds from his shotgun and then retreated to the trunk area to reload his shotgun. And of course, Trooper Summers was able to get the radio broadcast out. And basically what Dennis and Lancaster did is they moved to the back of their vehicle, and they had the high ground. Their truck is a little bit higher than what the trooper car is. So they're kind of not looking down on them, but they can have they can see better at where the troopers are positioned by looking underneath the car than they can Dennis and Lancaster. Okay? And so they began to fire on them. And then once, and of course, you know, this is real, a lot of times this is very underestimated, but the gun that Dennis actually stole from his brother-in-law a couple of days after the escape didn't have a front sight on it. Okay. And so from you know, several yards away, he was able to fire that and strike Trooper Summers at the back of the car, right, without a front sight. So he's a very good point of aim shooter, and that, of course, that round was immediately fatal to the trooper, and obviously they could see that, right, that was a fatal hit. And so then they began to focus in on the passenger side where Trooper Summers was. And if you look at the trajectories, all right, the way that the rounds entered the windshield, and you look at how they penetrated those bench seats, they basically began to advance on them while doing suppression fire. So they were putting rounds into that front windshield where Trooper Summers was, pinning him down in the front seat where he couldn't raise up and fight back. And then one of them walked around and shot Trooper Summers under his armpit at contact range with a shotgun, and that took his life. And then they stole the trooper's weapons, disarmed them of their weapons, stole their weapons, got in the pickup, and that's when they left the scene. And then, you know, just a few minutes later is when the aircraft picked them up and started moving the units to try to prevent them from getting into Caddo.
So the other units, other law enforcement in the area, do they know pretty quickly what had happened to these troopers?
They don't. They knew they did not have radio contact with them. So when you listen to the audio traffic, you'll hear that after the shootout takes place in Caddo, then the plane leaves Caddo and it flies back over to Kennefic to go try to check on the troopers. And so that's a pretty emotional radio traffic that you hear, because, you know, you hear the pilots, they've just witnessed this gun battle at Caddo. They know that one trooper's dead. They know that another trooper's wounded, and they know both suspects are down. And now they turn, bank their plane, and head back west to go find the troopers that we can't make contact with. So in their audio traffic, you hear them say, "We've got two troopers down here at Kennefic, and they're in bad shape. Get us two more ambulances." Wow. You know, they could see what has happened because mm-hmm. it was a pretty graphic crime scene, but they really can't do anything about it. Mm. And so units had to peel off of what at Caddo and come out there and now, you know, preserve that crime scene.
How many pilots were overhead?
So there's only one pilot, but we'd assigned a trooper who was an observer.
Okay, so and there were two in the. Was it a plane? Or?
Yes, is one of our 182s.
Okay,
and they were flying up there. One was an OHP pilot. One was an OHP observer.
Got it. So they go and they're trying to now warn the other troopers in the area, or whatever they can do
at Kennefic. Uh-huh. Yes. So they're as soon as the gunfire starts, you can hear in the audio where they're talking to the black and whites coming southbound, telling them, you know, slow down because you're going to have gunfire, and the gunfire is going southeast to northwest, right? So they're letting them know that there's gunfire going in this direction both ways. So if you're coming in from the south, you know, slow down before you get right in the middle of it, or you could get caught in crossfire. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to prevent the crossfire. And as they're doing that, that's about the time that Lieutenant Grimes gets struck. And so you immediately hear them say, "Get us an ambulance to Caddo. We got a trooper down." Now, they can't see that there's a trooper down. It's just by the way the scene looked, it was obvious that a trooper was down.
Were two troopers shot in that area? Hoyt was shot as well, correct?
Yeah, so Lieutenant Hoyt Hughes was driving Zebra 22, which used to be my badge number. Mm-hmm. They were driving Zebra 22, and then Lieutenant Grimes was a passenger there. So what happened was one of the kids that were playing there, when you listen to Hoyt say, as they made that turn, they started westbound, they could see all the kids running towards the sirens, because there's a lot of sirens. And he thought that the kids thought that that was fire trucks. Mm. And so he could see them running. And one of those kids that was running was eventually the undersheriff down in Bryan County. Yeah. But he was like 7 years old when that happened. Mm. And so he was there, and I've actually talked to him. And so what Hoyt could see was that if he didn't position his trooper car between those kids and the escapees, that they would have a hostage situation going on. So they basically pulled their car in between the kids on one side of the street and the bad guys on the other side of the street. That's what put them in such close combat. Wow. With those bad guys. So that's, you know, and you have to know that you're probably not going to make it out of this deal. Yeah. So that just goes to show the heroism those guys had.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. So Grimes was shot and killed at the scene. Hughes was hit.
Yes. Yes, he was wounded. So what Lieutenant Hughes did is, after he was wounded, he still got out of the vehicle and he took his partner's rifle and he returned fire on them, pinning them down, which gave Lieutenant Williams time to move in, take his position, and then Hughes could not get back in his vehicle. Okay. So he walked beside his vehicle because it was still in gear, and he's steering it so he can get his partner out of that line of fire, even though his partner is deceased in the front seat. Mm-hmm. And then he took a lever action rifle and then walked back down without any cover and continued with the gunfight.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is amazing.
So you go around, do you talk to the academies every year, the cadets and the R academies every year about this?
Yeah, I have talked to, not every year, I have talked to our cadets about the Caddo Kenefic deal. And I've also put together a presentation for our dispatchers, and I did that 2 years in a row so they could understand, you know, how critical it is to, you know, to get information, how critical it is to be familiar, you know, with the areas and, you know, things like that. And also let them hear that audio traffic of, you know, the gunfight and then the plane getting back over and finding the troopers out on that county road near Kenefic, you know, because, what I teach, you know, when I teach this class is I really do call it those missed opportunities. You know, had we said, we have two people and they're very violent. So a lot of times you can have a jailbreak, but they may be in for bogus checks. Okay. So you really need to be able to run your intel pretty fast on these escapees and do a threat assessment on them. And then a lot of times that threat assessment is going to determine how much of a response you make to that call. But someone has to run that intel. Someone has to be on that the moment that we know there's a jailbreak. And then someone has to make the decision that we're going to get engaged in this thing for the next 8 to 10 or 12 hours. And it's really important that we realize that by the time we've made these decisions, all right, at 60 miles per hour, these people are probably 45 minutes to an hour away from where they escaped at. And we never should assume that they're going to Dallas or that they're going to New York. Okay? Very few go to Dallas and New York. Most people have a plan to escape from the confines of the jail. They don't have a plan once they get outside the confines of the jail. They're making that up as they go. And that's that first 24 hours is the best opportunity the police has to get in front of them and encounter them, because they have not yet got a plan of what to do once they're outside those prison walls. And in this situation, there was just, a lot of missed opportunities. There was a, you know, missed opportunity of following up on the Datsun, all right? There was a lady that was trying to report her husband missing the following day because he was in his ranch in Gertie. Well, it's not illegal to not call your wife. So she had a very difficult time getting anyone to take a missing persons report on him. And it wasn't until about 4 years ago that we were able to track down his family members and find the right genealogy of his family to take DNA swabs of them. And now we have a DNA profile for this missing man on file with NamUs. So, and then that's cross-checked all the time against medical examiner DNA records. So hopefully one of these days, you know, some of his remains will be found. It may just be a bone, right? But that bone will still have enough, viable DNA to be sent to NamUs, and they cross-check that and find out that that's actually, our missing person from 1978.
We appreciate Captain Hampton and all of his extensive knowledge on this. And so we talked about about a year ago, maybe a little more, we sat down with Lieutenant Mike Williams, who brought this whole deal to an end when he was a young trooper. We talked to his wife and kind of what they remember about that day. And it was an honor, first of all, to be able to talk to him. And it was just very interesting to hear it from both of their perspectives and kind of what was going through their mind on that day. And, we talk about spouses and how important they are. And, she's sitting at home not knowing what has happened to her husband. So it was very interesting to me to hear her talk about that.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time, how the spouse or the significant other at home really is the concrete that holds it all together, because, the work that we do, and then we have to go home, and it's hard to switch that off. And so she kind of talks a little bit about, her feel on that. But it was really an honor to sit down as a younger trooper. I've only been doing it 10 years, and for this man that had been involved in such a critical incident in his career, and I love doing that. Anytime I get to sit down with a retired trooper or a retired law enforcement for that matter, it's really an honor. And so to hear him recount, not only that, there were some things off the record or off of the microphone that we were talking about, and as he gets older, and it's just a pleasure to be able to talk to him. And so let's listen to him as he recounts this.
And I just jumped up, didn't tell the captain. I just said, "I'm going. I know where they're going." And I jumped in my car and took off.
And as Lieutenant Williams is heading to where he believed Dennis and Lancaster were going, he hears Trooper Summers and Trooper Young over the radio.
I heard both of them calling in, saying, "We've been hit, we've been hit, we've been hit." Yeah, they did that.
And as Lieutenant Williams arrives at the scene where Lieutenant Hoyt Hughes and Lieutenant Pat Grimes have been engaged in a gunfight with Dennis and Lancaster, this is what Lieutenant Williams recalls.
But he looked back at me and looked back at me, and he's raising his arm up. And when he did, I just popped him, pop, pop.
We did hear one of the law enforcement officers hollering and saying that there were troopers dead everywhere. Yeah. And we had no way of knowing. And my children were there. My house was full of people. And it was heart-wrenching. And my son got on his bicycle and rode up to the hospital, which was a block away from our house. And he kept going around and around and around the hospital to try to see his dad or someone that had known whether, he was okay, so he could come back and tell us. And it was a horrible experience.
Oh, I bet. And he's out there doing all this stuff, what he has to do, but what you're doing at home has to be just as excruciating, the waiting and not knowing.
It was bad, and it was a long time before we heard whether or not that Mike was okay. And then it was a long time before he really was okay.
I'm not ashamed of what I did.
Oh, no.
Because it had to be done.
Yes, sir.
I'm not real proud of it, though, because I took a man's life, but I had to.
Yes, sir.
And I'd do it again.
Sure, you heard the term hero quite a bit after that.
Not really. I'm not a hero. I'm just a state trooper doing what he had to do. And I hope everybody else does the same thing, getting those kind of situations.